Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 23rd of December 1923, the peer with the idea. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. Herbert Asquith, the quasi-leader of the Liberal Party, has stated that he will be voting to bring down the government when Parliament reopens in the new year. George II of Greece has been exiled. This would appear to be related to an attempted military coup last month, which I didn't mention. Something I did mention, in the 1st of October episode no less, was separatist disturbances in Dusseldorf in occupied Germany. This has now come to court, a French court, with the police being the ones in the dock. In case you are toying with the idea that the French are valiantly confronting the curse of police brutality, they're not. They're just on the side of the separatists. The Times has published a couple of articles on the situation in China. In 1911, the monarchy was abolished. According to the Crozier monarchy theory, when monarchies collapse, countries are in for a long period of instability. The Chinese are doing their best to adhere to the theory, with regional warlords jealously guarding their fiefs from an almost powerless central authority. Henry Ford, pioneer of the automotive production line, and someone no one would describe as a powerless central authority, has announced that he will not be running for president. See the 14th of January episode. I saw this in Tuesday's edition. A deputation from Brighton Corporation, which waited on the Southern Railway to ask for the electrification of the Brighton line, was told that there was no hope for this until all the suburban lines had been electrified, and that even when the Brighton line came to be electrified, the present 60-minute service could not be improved upon. So how did things turn out? The line was electrified in 1933, which seems pretty swift to me. But the fastest train from London Victoria to Brighton does not take 60 minutes. It takes 58 minutes. I could make a comment about the inadequacies of state-owned railways, but I suspect this is more a comment about the technical limits of railways and the problems of running trains in South London, rather than anything to do with economic organisation. The Southern Railway has been making something of a habit of putting a damper on things this week, as we will see later. On Thursday, the Times reported on the Westminster Play, a traditional Christmas production put on by Westminster School. Well, I think it's Westminster School, the article doesn't specifically say so. For that matter, the article doesn't specifically say that it's a Christmas tradition. Anyway, helpfully, the Times published both the prologue and epilogue. Unhelpfully, it's in Latin, without translation. I saw this in Saturday's edition. A number of offices will be opened experimentally in Paris on and after January the 1st for the transmission of phototelegraphic messages by the system invented by Monsieur Edouard Bellin to Lyon and Strasbourg. By this service, plans, pictures, models, texts of written and printed documents will be transmitted and exact reproductions of the originals will be delivered to the person to whom they are addressed. The cost of these phototelegrams will vary from 2 shillings 6 pence to 5 shillings, according to the dimensions of the document or picture to be transmitted, which must not exceed 5.3 inches by 3.75 inches. He's invented the fax, hasn't he? The swine. Yes, I know it sounds all useful and stuff, but only if you've never worked in an office cursed by its chattering, intermittently functioning presence. In the movie Office Space, they famously and cathartically beat one to death with a baseball bat. Good. Lenin, ruler of Soviet Russia, may still be alive, but it is clear that he is not long for this world. In that knowledge, his underlings have started squabbling amongst themselves. This is from Saturday, the 22nd of December. The undivided leadership of the present chiefs is coming to an end. Lenin's deputy, Stalin, has published an article in which he accuses Trotsky of duplicity, because Trotsky, himself a member of the Central Committee, voted for a recent resolution denouncing the formation of groups within the party, and then addressed a letter to a party conference in which he diplomatically supported the opposition. That is, people calling for groups within the party. While ostensibly defending the resolution of the Central Committee. Stalin reproaches Trotsky with pretending to belong to the old Revolutionary Guard, though he has no right to. Trotsky played a lone hand till after the Bolshevist Revolution, then formally joined the Bolshevists. My understanding is that he was pivotal to the Bolshevist or October Revolution, but was a lone hand, as the Times would have it, for the February Revolution, which led to the abdication of the Tsar and the creation of the Provisional Government. He hints that Trotsky is ready to turn his coat, and definitely accuses him of belonging to the opposition camp, and of creating and fostering division between the old and young communists, the latter of whom he caresses for his own purposes. That last bit could be subject to misinterpretation. To the best of our knowledge, there was nothing creepy about Stalin. He was merely a sadistic mass murderer. More to the point, this is the first time Stalin, has appeared in the pages of the Times for a very long time. Any number of other communists, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Bukharin, Rykov, and of course Trotsky, have, but not Stalin. And here he is condemning a figure as celebrated as Trotsky. It feels to me as if the power struggle is already over. Oh, and it says this. The Soviet press states that great discontent exists among the peasantry, who believe that the recent elections were faked. There is a proposal for a motorway between London and Liverpool. Lord Montague of Bewley, the autophile's autophile, is in favour. This is from Tuesday, the 18th of December. I argued a year ago that a really comprehensive scheme of trunk road building was the best possible way of using a large proportion of those out of work. Not sure about the economics here. Since then, the need for making roads fit for modern mechanical traffic has become much greater. I give a few instances. The traffic radiating from Liverpool has grown from 884,208 tonnes in 1913 to 9,326,928 tonnes in 1922. In my own county of Hampshire, the traffic in motor vehicles alone has risen from 24,859 tonnes in 1911 to 176,302 tonnes in 1922. How would you know? Seriously, how could you measure that, or even estimate it? Having said that, everything else we know, the end of the horse pass, Western Front logistics, suggests that there has been a massive expansion in motorised transport. The idea of a motorway is novel to most people here. They do not grasp easily what it means. A motorway is a road made for motor traffic only, built with bridges over or under railways, canals and other roads, wide enough for four lines of traffic, with no gradient exceeding 1 in 49 and no curve sharper than a half mile radius. For reference, the steepest current gradient on a British motorway is 1 in 22, and the tightest curve slightly more than half a mile. Both these records are held by the M90 in Scotland. In other words, they pretty much got it right first time. To meet the possible objections that motorways should be nationalised, it would be easy to enact that the government should have power to acquire any such road on the same sort of basis as exists in the case of railways already. To those who dislike the idea of tolls as a so-called retrograde step, I would point out that railways and canals charge tolls and obtain traffic all the same because it pays traffic to use them. One does wonder how much better British motorways would flow these days if people had to pay for them at the point of use. He goes on. Precisely in a similar way, if the owner of a private motor car, motor lorry or van, can save one penny on a ton mile, he will use the motorway on which there is no speed limit, where the running costs are lower, and where he can use at least double the number of trailers. No speed limit, eh? Sounds wonderful. I'd love to know what he means by doubling the number of trailers here. Sounds like a recipe for disaster, although I understand they have them in Australia. He goes on to describe some of the problems caused by greater road traffic. Go into wayside villages, where motor lorries are pounding through all day long, and you will see cracked ceilings and walls, testifying to the stresses on the roadside buildings, while the enjoyment of the road in the day and sleep by night are difficult to the roadside population. After the Napoleonic Wars, it was not till the railway era began to develop a new kind of transport that trade, internal and external, revived, and the stimulus of railways, then given, bore the country forward on a wave of prosperity almost to the 70s. And railways were built then and since, let us note, by pioneers with private capital, as indeed our turnpike roads were improved between 1820 and 1845. Each age evolves the peculiar system of transport suitable to its needs, and now must and will come the motorway. If we assume now means within the next 53 years, which is how long it took for motorways to link London with Liverpool. The political party or parties which grasp at this great new constructive idea and help on this beneficent development will earn the gratitude of this generation and be famous in the annals of our history as having been gifted with vision and inspired by courage. The first motorway in Britain was completed in 1958 by a Conservative government. Somehow I always seem to miss out on the annual celebrations of the vision of Harold Macmillan and the courage of Ernest Marples. It was Marples, wasn't it? Actually, it turns out to be a chap called Harold Watkinson, who I've never heard of before. Not everyone thinks this is a winner. This is from Wednesday the 19th, and comes from an E.S. Shrapnel Smith, President and Chairman of the National Council, the Commercial Motor Users Association. Every contact with the problems of road traffic and of the internal trade of the country convinces me that any such motorway, assuming the funds for its construction to be forthcoming, must within a few years of its opening become an abandoned and derelict property. If national funds are to be put up on behalf of the motorway, there will, in the considered opinion of the association, of which I have the honour to be president, be a grave waste of public money. He goes on to dispute the savings, the size of the market, suggest that greater speed does not make up for terminal delays, and claim that through traffic is in decline due to better railways. And he's not alone. This is from Saturday the 22nd, and it's from H.A. Walker, General Manager of the Southern Railway. If and when the scheme takes concrete shape, the railway attitude will be, inter alia, that the project is nothing but an endeavour to provide an alternative means of transport through an area now adequately served by railways, and Parliament would not be justified in authorising such a scheme. I think what you mean is you don't like the competition. He goes on. On the other hand, if any substantial proportion of the more remunerative traffic of the railways is to be diverted to the motorway, traffic still remaining to the railways must assume an added burden in the form of higher rates or impaired services, in order to enable the companies to secure the net revenues to which they are entitled under the provisions of the Railways Act 1921. The traffic likely to be so affected will be principally raw materials, i.e. coal, iron ore, etc., and it is upon the cheapening of these commodities that our future as an industrial nation must largely depend. In 1923, the government not only determined what rates railways could charge, but also how much profit they could make. Walker is pointing out that what was once a problem solely for the railway is now a problem for government. This is one of the problems with state intervention. There are always knock-on effects. As we know, this railway did not get built then. It will be interesting to see whether it failed on commercial or political grounds. What is clear, or clear enough, is that the proposal was on exactly the right little white lines. Anyway, that is all for this week. I don't aim to have anything up next week. I'm taking a break for Christmas. Well, I say that, but I tell myself that I'll be working on a couple of specials. We'll see. I aim to be back in the new year, but I promise nothing. In the meantime, happy humbug. Scrooge is right.